Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, my Christmas elf. I mean, wait, no, it's not Christmas anymore.
No, we're keeping that in. This is unstructured, unedited. This is real talk.
That's right.
This is now one of those fun conversational podcasts that you like to listen to, where it's just two people who you already know from a different thing talking about things aimlessly for an hour and a half.
We scoured the web to see if anyone had made a podcast like that. We couldn't find one. We looked everywhere. Please, just one podcast about two buddies talking. But
I love a podcast that is just two comedians who all know the other 75 comedians who've been on the show. It's just a rotating line of comedians going on each other's podcasts.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Ponzi scheme, podcasting, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it never pays off, that's for sure. And we are welcoming you into a fresh new round of Weird Medieval Guys podcasts with a little Q&A episode, as we often do around the New Year season. So, thanks to everyone on the Discord who sent us in their questions. There were some great ones. If you want to send us in questions for next year, then hop on the Discord. We'll link it in the bio.
You mean in description?
Yeah, in description. Exactly. There was actually someone on Substack who messaged me and said that we mentioned cul-de-sacs when we were talking about the cul-de-s in the last episode, and she seemed quite distressed that we hadn't called it a cul-de-sac.
Oh.
Which was yeah, missed opportunity. But truly. Anyways, so I think we're just gonna jump right in.
Yeah. What's the first question, Olivia?
Thanks to Iona, who said, I would love it if you did a live commentary on the King and Conqueror miniseries. Well, in order to do that, we would have to watch the whole thing start to finish.
Which is 10 hours, and then, like, yeah, and then release 10 hours of podcasts.
Yep, and folks, we've seen a bit of that series, and we had thoughts about it.
Yeah, I think that this is a nice question because it's almost like a way for us to kind of reflect on the our own six episode miniseries.
Yeah. I think just to back up as well for anyone who doesn't know, King and Conqueror was a recent BBC miniseries they put out about the Norman Conquest.
Yeah, I think
like a drama series.
As opposed to a comedy, which I would have absolutely loved.
Well, not like a documentary.
I think we'll get to the production design in a second, because the production design is an issue for me. I think one of the things that I find really strange about this series is that it's very clearly like a Game of Thrones kind of reskin, right? Taking a different period of English history and doing the Game of Thrones effect on it. But what is actually really interesting to me is that they don't key into the ways in which the story of the Norman Conquest is very Game of Thrones, which is that actually there is a, and I think I referenced this in like episode two or whatever, but there's a lot of Canute in Robert Baratheon, and the fact that the whole story is this dynastic conflict that's kicked off originally by the death of a usurper king. And what's really interesting, what's really bizarre about King and Conqueror is we start kind of in media res with England needs to elect a new king. Why? Dunno. We don't hear anything about the previous king. We don't understand. We don't really talk about, like, why is Edward the Confessor being in Normandy? Like, what is any of this, basically? And then the moment where it broke me a little bit was when they start talking about the earldoms as if they're like the houses of Game of Thrones, yeah, like their kingdoms. It's like the blood of Wessex and the house of Northumbria. It's like, these are just jobs.
Yeah.
These are governors. They're not, like, these are royal appointments.
It threw out basically everything that makes the original narrative interesting. And I just find it interesting because I was just so baffled by the fact that they sacrificed. It would be one thing, I guess, if they had done that, like, in service of giving us something that felt inventive and original, but it felt like they threw out so much in service of just giving us, like, more shots of people, like, draped in furs riding on horses or, like, talking to each other in these, rooms. Like, dimly candlelit rooms.
Not that there wasn't a lot of that in the original story, but...
No, yeah, but it was, like, I mean, just, like, certain... I think for me... massive offender was just the time scaling of everything. I mean, yes. Again, Aaron and I watched, like, most of the first
half. We watched episode one, and then we skipped through the rest of it.
First couple of episodes. Right.
It was a while ago.
I mean, the fact that, like, Harold and William are the same age, and they're also, like, the same age as Edward for some reason.
Harold and William being the same age is fine. William and Edward being the same age is incomprehensible because the entire point of that conflict is that they're not. He's meant to be his heir.
Yeah.
Like, this, and so, okay, for those who haven't seen it, but have listened to every episode of this podcast, the fundamental, in addition to the, like, Canute doesn't exist of it all, the fundamental structural change that they make to the story is that in the real world, there's a 20-year time skip between the coronation of Edward the Confessor and the Battle of Hastings, right? Which allows for an entire new generation of people to come onto the scene who are William the Conqueror, Harold Godwinson, and Harold Hardrada. In the show, it's never, I mean, maybe in the bits we skipped, it's addressed how much time has passed.
They don't look any older at the
same. No, they look the same.
20 years older.
There's one point at which, where there's a scene where the King of France is hanging out with a child. And my, like, endlessly optimistic mind was like, oh, that's William. And we're going to do the time, and now we're going to do the time skip. And then, you know.
Nope.
And then what they did... We are gonna say some positive things in a minute. There's like three very positive things that I really like about the show. But what they did to Harold Hardrada, I think, is the most offensive.
Yeah.
They
made his ass bald, didn't they?
They made him like this dour, glowering, like.
But didn't they also make him bald?
I can't remember. I think he might be bald.
Which is so unforgivable.
He's Harold Fairhair.
Oh, no.
But like, the fact that. And then you meet him in the show, and he's, like, this dark, grim kind of, like, specter. Which, obviously, you know, I understand what they're going for within the context of the show. I understand why they made him like that. But as, an anachronism, the Harold Hardrada of the sources is this sort of swashbuckling hero. It's like, ha ha, huzzah! What a luck!
It's sad because for me, the whole, you know, the sources give you so much to work with. Mm-hmm. And then the relative paucity of sources gives you so much creative freedom. And then the fact that it's a TV show and you can do whatever you want with it, unbound by the historical sources, gives you all the freedom in the world. And to have that much freedom with what is like an inherently interesting story and to do absolutely nothing with it. Like, I just want to know who is the audience for a show that's about these three, like, distinct groups, but none of them have any distinguishing features.
They look the same.
None of the characters are distinct from none of the main characters are distinct from each other in any way, and the motivations are completely flat. It's like, it's a show. I mean, it's not even a show for people who like Game of Thrones, because at least it has, like, that has the character drama and the court intrigue. This was just, like, a show for people who, like, I don't even know who the audience is.
I think the audience is Game of Thrones fans, but it's like, I think it's just, right, I am fine with historical anachronism to make a story, kind of, to either change things about a story to make it either more digestible or to kind of get to the core of what the story is or to make it more interesting and more kind of complex and fantastical, right? The reason why I struggled a lot with this show and the reason why I struggled a lot with Braveheart, and Braveheart is always the movie that I point to, is like, this is how you shouldn't do the Middle Ages, is because in both those cases, like, you made every change you made the story less interesting. You took a really complex world and you flattened it. And Harold Hardrada, he should, when you see Harold, if we were going to make this show, or if I was going to make this show, when you meet Harold Hardrada, he should be lounging in a great wooden throne. He should be draped in, like, the finest silks.
Yes. And it's like, because when you look up this show, the first Google, like, results suggestions you get are, like, what's going on in this show? Who are all the characters? Like, guide to the characters. And the reason for that is not that there are too many characters. There aren't, actually.
There's the same number of characters as there are in our show.
But they're completely indistinct, and they give us absolutely no cues whatsoever using, like, the visuals and the environment and the script writing to distinguish them. And so it all just does become, like, slop. And it's also, like, and there's so many cuts in between these different timelines. It's like, it's a miniseries. You could, like, do one episode that's just about the Vikings and just about that aspect of it, and it would just feel much more whole. Like, they're also not doing anything interesting with, like, the interwoven narratives. It's literally just cuts back. It's like they filmed three identical, basically, plot lines, and then just, like, hacked them up and put them back together.
Yeah. Now, we've been very negative. Let's talk about the things that are good.
Folks, we love Tostig. We love Tostig Godwinson.
Yeah, so
making him, like, a really sullen, like, redhead twink with a bowl cut was so inspired. There were some good casting decisions and good actors in this show.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that I think we definitely did when we started researching the show that I think he's not... One of the interesting things about Tostig is that he's not a character in the sort of popular, the sort of popular consciousness of 1066. But he was kind of, when we were researching the show, he was a character that we really keyed into.
Yeah.
Because he is such a great, he fits the archetype of, I think I've compared him to, like, Iago from Othello, or, to use an equally, like, literary reference, Erebus from the Horus Heresy. Because the idea of, like, the guy who kind of, like, gets scorned and sort of sets all of these events in motion and ends up destroying himself and everybody else around him is an incredibly compelling archetype. And so we really keyed into him as, like, we didn't explicitly say this, I think, on the show, but I think the impression that you, if you were telling this as a story, you wouldn't want to make Tostig's motivations and actions matter.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, Snorri, or whoever wrote the Heimskringla, is definitely saying Tostig Godwinson is the reason why Harald Hardrada invades England. And Harald Hardrada is probably the reason why Harald Godwinson loses Hastings.
Yeah, exactly. And they do a good job of showing him, like, getting kicked around and stuff. Like, he's really, like, downtrodden. And, like, I think
Svein Godwinson is in it as well.
Godwinson, they nail him. The background casting was really good, because Svein Godwinson and Godwin is the best
piece of casting in the entire show. Because he's like a character from, like, Snatch or something. He's like a disgusting, like...
Yeah.
Like a he's this disgusting kind of almost underworld character who's risen to the top through sheer, like, bloody-mindedness.
Yeah.
And the guy they got to play him nails that.
I know. And he does capture, like, the sort of slightly benevolent paternal vibe as well. It's a very good performance.
Yeah. Also really good casting. Eddie Marsan as Edward the Confessor. Yeah. Fantastic.
Really good, yeah. Just a guy who looks, like, a bit wet spiritually. He's, like, spiritually a bit damp.
Every time he looks at a character, he's just, like, he's giving those big eyes.
He gives off the vibe of, like, a basset hound or one of those dogs that's, like, always got, like, crust on its eyes. And, like, it's, like, its nose is always, like, wet. And maybe it breathes a bit weird, but you kind of, like, you have an affinity for it because it's a bit pathetic.
The best scene, I think, in the first episode is what him catching up with, like, I think it with William, and he's like, yes, I've kept this, look at this finger I've kept of this saint. Like, obviously we've talked in previously about, like, how the kind of Edward the Confessor as this ultra pious, ultra religious guy is probably this kind of post rationalization for the fact that he couldn't get his wife pregnant and is probably historically inaccurate. But this is a great example of, like, actually using, sort of leaning into the historical inaccuracies to give a really kind of fun, creepy performance.
Exactly.
So that is contrast the treatment of Edward the Confessor, which is, you could say is kind of wrong, but I don't really care, with the rest of it. And I just no big story is easy. Like, this is easy to tell.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not easy to adapt into, like, a massive, into a massive, like, you know, lavish miniseries. But you just kind of took all the fun out of it.
Yeah.
Like at the fucking Battle of Stamford Bridge when Harold falls off his horse and it's like, a fall is lucky for a traveler.
Huzzah! No, exactly. Exactly. And it's like, it felt like there were a lot of talented people working on it, both behind and in front of the camera. But I don't know. I feel like it was probably just one of those things where it was like rushed, or there was like conflicting sort of, you know, editorial inputs from various people. It was like, it just didn't come together. Really,
there was one part of it that was genuinely unforgivable.
Was that when they go to London?
Yeah.
When they go to London, and London is like it's like a Crusader King's like loading screen.
It's not even Crusader, it's sub Crusader
King's. London is like a sort of cluster of hovels surrounded by like a fence made out of sharpened wooden sticks.
No, it's not made out of wooden sticks, because that would actually be almost period accurate.
Actually,
it's this like, it almost looks like, you know, when you are building like a wall in an RTS and you like drag it and it sort of repeats the same pattern. It looked like that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Thames isn't there.
Yes.
Which is a huge issue for what London is.
Yeah.
It's like London is, you know, London's not the center of the universe in the 11th century, but it's the biggest city in Britain. It's one of the biggest cities in Western Europe. It's not five buildings and a castle.
And it's like, again, you know, put London on top of a mountain for all I care. Like, put London in the clouds for all I care. Just make it interesting. And yeah they didn't.
On the Norman, King of Roland.
So, question from S, who says, my sister went to a restaurant with her boyfriend that was medieval themed, and she said that they got the, quote, medieval experience.
Okay.
What would be a good reproduction / representation of the medieval experience, in quotes, in your opinion?
Long tables.
Plates made out of bread.
Oh, yes, bread plate.
Trencher. Mm. Get your trencher in.
Ale. Only the realest of ales.
Only the realest of ales. Maybe some wines. I mean, I think, you know, the medieval experience, candles, obviously, like, you know, could encompass a lot of things. I mean, if you're actually talking about, like, a medieval restaurant, what would a restaurant be like in the Middle Ages? And you're talking about, like, a tavern, that's one thing. But if we're talking about, like, design your authentically medieval
experience. Yeah. Let's go with that.
Fireplaces, I mean, tapestries.
Enormous tapestries, a big rug, the most expensive thing in the room.
Dogs, there are always
dogs
kicking
about. Everywhere.
You're feeding scraps to the dogs under the table. This is like every medieval drawing of a feast. You're feeding scraps to the dogs.
No forks.
No forks, that's right.
I think the experience is, first of all, it's a set fucking menu. You're not ordering off anything. You go and you pay your 25 quid and you're just gonna get what you get. So that's the first authentic aspect. And then I think dogs, candles, lots of candles. It's a big room. Your seating is also determined by how much your host likes you as well.
Yes, of course.
What about the food? What do we got?
I mean, you're eating birds that ain't ever been eaten before. You're eating herons. You're eating owls. Like, fuck it. Whatever. You're going to eat a fucking...
Owls,
like,
inside of herons?
Yeah, exactly. So you're going to eat, like, an eel inside of, like, a platypus, inside of, like, I don't know, a turkey vulture. Everything has, like, cloves and sugar in it and cinnamon.
It all tastes weird. It's over-seasoned.
Yeah, it's, like, over-seasoned. It all has, like, raisins and almonds in it as well. Everything is spiced like a kind of pilau rice type dish.
Yes.
Because that's what they were into. No, but your dessert is going to be quite nice and light, because your dessert will be like some sort of fried, like, fritter type things drizzled in honey, probably.
Yeah. So, okay, so I'm cribbing here from a tweet from the Merchant Adventurers Hall in Twitter account, which is in York. This is a list of food for a feast at the hall in 1448. 21 capons, 72 fowls, 6 suckling pigs, 12 rabbits, 6 herons, 2.5 ounces of saffron, and 10 ounces of white sugar.
Yeah, boy.
And to drink 170 pints of wine and 416 pints of ale.
Yeah, boy.
The herons is tough for me.
Yeah.
Everything else on that list, I'm like, you know what, sure.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Suckling pigs, I can get into that. Capons, I can get into that.
Yeah.
Herons, there's not a lot of meat on a heron.
No.
You're not getting a lot of bird for your bird.
They were quite into, like, sort of reconstitution, though, that they would, like, roast a heron, but, like, put all the feathers on afterwards and, like, do something weird with it. So probably would be some theatrics about that. You probably have, like, some good entertainment, you know? You would definitely have, like, a juggler or some musicians.
Yes. Oh, there's harps.
Get, like, a hurdy-gurdist in.
Yes.
And then afterwards, you just get to, like, dance, you know? You just have to do, like, a little clap, clap, shimmy dance. One of those, like, stiff medieval dances.
Well, okay, you say stiff medieval dances. I have always pushed back on this because I think that the recreations of the medieval, what a sort of after-dinner medieval dance would be like, it's so formal because everybody's like, well, let's recreate what's on the page, or let's try and do this. It would be, everybody would be drunk and falling over each other and, like, a little bit lechy, probably, and I've been to too many Kayleys to really, like, if somebody was to historically recreate a Kaylee, it would be very dry. But a Kaylee in real life is essentially a big fight.
I don't know. I feel like because so much of the point of the dance was to, like, stoke sexual tension. I think that
that's
maybe
why I think
would,
it's being
I think it
gropey.
Would maybe, it would be reserved. It would be a little bit reserved. No, I don't think it would be gropey. It would not be gropey. It would be
depends on the crowd.
I think it would be sexy in an understated way.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's my fan. That's my fantasy of the ideal medieval dinner, at least.
I think we've learned a lot about. Okay, so in so in your ideal restaurant, there is an after dinner dance where you steal furtive glances.
Yes.
At the buxom maiden.
Oh my God! Yes. Listen to the one about pets.
Yes.
The one about the cosmos obviously was quite heavily informed by medieval Muslim scholarship. Obviously.
I mean, we had a whole episode about the Ottomans.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, but it's definitely like a world we're always dipping our toes back into. So
I think it's one of the things that we try to do quite often is we try not to treat medieval and as synonymous with Christian European. And if we're going to do, when we do an episode about like a general kind of like a cultural concept, like a medieval holiday party or medieval pets, we do try and at the very least get a little bit of perspective from each of the kind of Abrahamic religions.
Yeah.
Because it's it can be really helpful to kind of see where they agree and where they differ.
Exactly.
And this is now looking far into the future, but I would love to talk about like Damascus.
Yeah.
And the Levant and, oh man, I mean, it's to be honest, it's kind of, I before I started doing this series, I was always more interested in Islamic history than Christian history because it's more kind of, it's not what I grew up with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's always really fascinated me.
All right, Ad Cranock says, Pictish Beast, discuss.
Okay, so I'm going to give you, like, a very quick run-up for those of you who don't know what this is. The Picts are a slightly mysterious Celtic people who lived in the northeast of Scotland in the early medieval period. They'd sort of been absorbed by the Scots by the 11th century. In what process? It's vague. But one of the things they did leave, they didn't leave behind any writing, but what they did leave behind was a lot of symbol stones that are the source of mystery of what did they mean, because there are a lot of stones. They clearly meant something specific because the symbols recur. So it's a hieroglyphic sign language of some kind. I'm not going to get into what did the Pictish stones mean. I just want to talk about one symbol particularly, which is there is this, most of the animals depicted in these stones are very easy to like identify, like, oh, that's a boar, that's a whatever. And there's one that looks kind of weird called, if you just Google the Pictish beast, it will come up.
Yeah, I'm going to Google it right now. Can I just give like a sort of description of it? I mean, it looks like a kind of anthropomorphic clothes hanger, I would say. Not anthropomorphic, sorry. Just like, it looks like a kind of, you know, animate coat hanger.
Yeah. My hot take is, this is a fucking obviously a dolphin. It's obviously a weird looking dolphin. And the reason I say this, and I can tell by the nickname, I can tell by the name Ad Cranog, this is not going to be a totally, to our listeners, this is not going to be a totally new concept, but on the northeast coast of Scotland, there are a shitload of dolphins and small whales. You can see them everywhere. There's millions of the things. So you would be familiar with them if you were Pictish. And medieval depictions of whales always kind of look kind of fucked up.
Yeah, they definitely let the standard slip for the sea creatures, which is a strike against them for sure.
The one last thing I want to say about the Pictish beast, which I think it's fun, is that there is a Doctor Who episode in the season of Doctor Who that nobody but me has watched, season 10, which is the best season. One of the best seasons. I think it has the best season. We're not talking about my opinions about Peter Capaldi as the Doctor. That's for some spin-off show that we make down the line. But, like, there's an episode in season 10 called Eaters of Light that features a monster that is very clearly, what if that was a depiction of a real animal?
Yeah.
And Olivia, you want to Google it. You can't really, there's not really good pictures of it, but it's very clearly meant to be a sort of realized version of the Pictish beast. It's got the tendrils.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and it's an episode about him. It's an episode about the Doctor and Bill and Nardole going up to Caledonia in the Roman period and meeting the Caledonians and meeting the Lost Legions.
That's fun.
Yeah, it is fun.
Obviously, there's editorializing involved no matter what it is you're talking about. But I think, you know, we've built up a relationship, I think, with these stories, with the sort of medieval Europe extended universe that feels sort of personal. That being said, I think there are certain things that kind of we're interested in doing that step a little bit beyond the boundaries of what we usually do. So, like, we've talked about doing various sort of historiographical ones. So I'd really like to do one about the evolving relationship that people have with the Middle Ages. How did, like, our relationship with this time period and our perceptions of it change sort of since it ended? That Absolutely. Would be fun. And, like, you know, maybe this is a boring answer, but I think because, you know, the periodization is so important when it comes to the Middle Ages, and that, like, you know, defining it as such creates this very, like, well-defined period of history.
500 to 1500, baby.
Exactly. So I am also interested in the kind of, like, marginal events that we look at as defining the Middle Ages and how those, you know, altered human history. It's like print. I mean, I love printing. Mm-hmm. So just, like, you know, the whole culture around printing, you know, the Reformation and the New World as well, and how all of these things interacted to, like, catapult humanity into, you know, early modernity. I'm very interested in talking about that a little bit.
Yeah. And just to come back to what I was saying earlier, I do have a real ambition to talk about stories from outside of Europe and to get outside of the European Christian kind of framework, but I want to do it right. And that will, when we talk about the assassins and so on, we will be leaving Europe very much so. But I think it deserves a very careful level of attention. I'd love to get there one day, but I think we're ways away from being in the position where we can really get into the weeds of it in the way that we would want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then in terms of, like, the periodization of it, I think I would love to talk about I'd love to talk about the, like, Ottoman versus Holy Roman Empire war.
Yeah.
Because in you know, and the siege of Vienna, and, like, that would be, if we were gonna, like, end the show narratively, that would be where I would end it. Because it's the last great knight cavalry charge, basically, is the Polish winged hussars, but, like, I do want to, the Japan episode was kind of a microcosm of what we can still do within the limitations that we've kind of set ourselves, because A, thankfully, you know, 19th century Japan is something I know a lot about, and also, it still, like, allows us to talk about the Middle Ages as a concept.
Yeah.
And to do a kind of metatextual analysis of, like, what do we mean when we talk about a medieval society?
Exactly, yeah.
So yeah, basically, the reason why we don't do, we want to do things like that. The reason why we don't is because it's hard.
Question from Kosher Salt, who says, what's your go-to pub order?
Okay, this we've included because it's an important piece of lore.
I mean, yeah, so I don't know if we've talked about this in
we
the
don't
podcast
think we
before.
Have.
Oh man, let me grab a sip of my beer.
A cold beer. We are drinking a beer called cold beer.
Yeah. It does say cold beer.
And it is cold.
Well, it says lager. Oh, it's 3.4%. Oh, that's a bit disappointing.
Well, they gave us 10 of them for 10 quid.
Yeah.
It's not that disappointing.
No, it's probably for the best, actually. It's probably for the best. I mean, as you may have picked up, partially based on our behavior on this podcast, partially based on the sort of constant slurping noises,
we edit the slurps.
When we can.
We're not keeping the slurps in.
We do enjoy a beverage or two while recording. What is perhaps less well known was that this podcast was cooked up at the pub.
Yes.
In fact, Aaron and I... Oh gosh, more than 3 years ago now?
It's around about exactly 3 years ago, so...
No, it's more than 3 years now.
Because it was early January 2023.
I just mean, yeah. So in early January 2023, Aaron and I, in the midst of a cold, bleak London winter, went to a Tbilisi Georgian restaurant in Islington.
Yes, we did.
And we enjoyed the food thoroughly. It was my first, but far from my last time having Georgian food, I'll tell you that.
I'm such an evangelist. We need to do Georgia. Georgia's
no,
so
yeah.
fun.
Anyways,
they show they. That's a quick
no.
side. No, we have to do this. Quick sidebar on this. There's a great aside in the story of Georgia getting conquered by the Mongols, which is that they basically opened the gates to them because they thought Prester John was showing up.
No. Anyways, and while leaving the restaurant, sort of contentedly, but maybe still. Not hungry, but in search of something.
We weren't ready for the night to end.
Though we knew not what at the time. We wandered back towards the Highbury and Islington station, and we saw, like, glowing ahead of us like a beacon. You know?
It was
we,
like
we
the, it was like
it
the
was,
Van Gogh painting of the cafe.
We couldn't tell if it was the light at the end of the tunnel or just the oncoming train, but it was the sign for the White Swan, or maybe it's just called the Swan, the Highbury and
no,
Islington
it's the White
spoons,
Swan.
The White Swan. And we went in, and, you know... I mean, it was just like this magical place where pints cost like £2.50. And we realized then that our goal, our purpose, the reason why fate had brought us to London and crossed our paths was to go to Wetherspoons every week.
Also, we'd known each other for like 2 months at that point.
Yeah.
And at that point, at that night, we made a pledge to go to Wetherspoons every Thursday.
And call it Wetherspoons. That has become so firmly lodged in my vocabulary that it's funny to think that it's not a real word.
And Thursday has variously, like, has shifted meaning. So when it started getting warm out, we decided we're going to start having, like, drinks in the park and it's going to be called Weather's Day.
Yeah.
Because of the nice weather.
Exactly.
And, I mean, really, like, we'd hung out. A fair few times up to that point, but the experience of going to the pub every week sort of is really how we became like very good friends.
Yeah.
And it was at one of these with Thursdays that Olivia, having had about, I think, 5 pints at that point, or possibly 3 of the Black Dragon, which is
God.
A Welsh beer that's like 8%.
No, it's a cider.
Anyways. The Black Dragon
was
like,
I
do
said.
You want to do a podcast with me? And I was like, yes.
Yeah. Well, it was something that we had kind of joked about before. And then I think that was when I said, like, you know.
No, but for real, though.
Don't joke with me, bro. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And we did it.
And we did.
And we still make a podcast and we still go to the pub every week. Although we have long since.
I can't eat any more Wetherspoons food.
Really? That's what you say every time. And then we go to Wetherspoons like 2 days later. We still do go to Spoons
We've
a lot.
We've not been to Spoons in a while.
We went. 2 weeks ago?
No,
no, it was before Christmas.
Weeks ago was Christmas.
The last time, yeah. But we went to the Mile End.
We try and shake it up.
Yeah, but you gotta go for the Christmas pizza. Anyway.
the Grandma Butterfield's Christmas pizza.
My go-to pub order is a cider. I like a cider. I like
you that, love a Stouffer's.
I like that it tastes like appy juice. I like how quickly I can drink many of them. Cider is just a good beverage.
You swore off the Stouffer's Press, though, for a while.
Yeah.
Because you realized that your body was like 25% Stouffer's Press.
Yeah, it was. I was scrumped up, man. I don't want to talk about
you
it.
You had your stomach, if we cut you open, we would just see those little floating, like, white booger things. Oh. Yeah, and for me, I like a nice pale ale. I've kind of gone off lagers lately.
Yeah. Breadman asks, how would the quality of medieval bread vary across location and class?
I mean, it's very much the same as the quality of modern bread, which is that how much money you got.
Yeah. I mean, there's different variables. So there's the kind of grain that you use. So there's a clear hierarchy in that wheat is always seen basically as the best. And then you've got other things like rye and barley and spelts and whatnot. And those are kind of like the lesser options that will make like a denser sort of, yeah, less nice bread. So definitely like wealthy people can afford the wheat bread. They can afford the white bread, which is like the really finely ground flour with all the bits sift all those disgusting all the
nutritional
bits of protein
parts.
And fiber sifted out. And also I think like leavening as well, like a wealthy person or a middle class person is more likely to be able to have like a nice fluffy loaf of leavened bread that's baked in an oven, whereas like someone who is at the bottom of the social ladder might just be making sort of these like unleavened sort of flat cakes on their hearth, or they might even just be having like gruel. So
still going on about the unleavened bread after all this time.
Yeah, well, sometimes you don't have time to let your bread rise because somebody wants their slaves back.
And then of course it really comes down to variable A, what grows near you. Variable B, like, are you willing to spend a lot of money to buy bread that is less nutritious?
Yes. And then, of course, there are regional variations. I mean, like, bread, I would say, in Northern Europe is more of a staple in comparison. In Southern Europe, you still have it, but, like, pasta and noodles and dumplings are much more of a staple there, which, you know, these things didn't exist in England until relatively recently.
Yeah, 1996.
Yeah, I mean, you joke, but that's basically when pasta arrived in England.
Listen, you still can't get good fucking Mexican food in London, yeah, so. Yeah,
exactly.
If anyone knows a good...
In medieval Italy, man, they were having tacos every day.
Listen, this is a call out to my listeners. If anybody knows places in London that are good for Mexican food...
No, I've taken leave you to La Chingada. That one's good.
That was good, yeah.
The Sabbat says, if you could solve one mystery currently lost to time, what would it be? Anything, big, petty, anything. I mean, I only have a really cliche one, but like Voynich manuscript, obviously.
Which one's that again?
It's the mysterious manuscript that's written in a language that no one understands and has never been seen anywhere else. And it has like illustrations of plants that don't exist, and
it truly does feel like something that stepped out of a Borges like short story.
Yeah, because like structurally and statistically, like the alphabet with which it's written, the frequency of which like with which letters appear, like resembles a natural language much more than it resembles someone just writing down gibberish. But no one knows where it came from. It has been carbon dated to the Middle Ages, so we know it's that old. No one knows what the plants are that have been drawn in it. They don't resemble any other plants that have been seen before. And, you know, most likely it is just, like, a hoax that someone made up to, like, sell.
But it's an interesting hoax. It's a compelling hoax.
If someone has the money and the time and the energy to do that, why not just copy a different book and sell it, you know? It's like, yeah, it's a very strange little, artifact. I recommend looking into it. Erica the Red asks, You mentioned that Edward the Exile and his kids were living in Hungary until Edward the Confessor brought them back to England. But I'd like to know a little bit more about whatever was happening in medieval Hungary and Central Europe in general.
Yeah, I mean, Hungarians are interesting because they're very late arrivers to Europe. Like, the Carpathian Basin until, like, the 9th century, it's just a bunch of Slavs hanging out. And then in come these, like, steppe nomads from Central Asia. And I've always loved this because they pretty much immediately are just like, well, we've moved to the suburbs of Eurasia. We're going to become pastoralists now. And they just, I mean, they fight some wars with the Germans and sort of accidentally helped to kind of cohere the Holy Roman Empire in doing so. But, like, they mostly just pretty much immediately become a normal Christian kingdom, which is in and of itself incredibly interesting. And I think it speaks to the, like, there is something deeply, like, central, there's something deeply Central Asian about the, yeah, sure, why not, attitude to that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely.
I also love, I was doing some research about, like, because Hungary is not, The exonym versus endonym thing is always really interesting to me, and Hungary being so different from what Hungarians call Hungary was really interesting to me, because obviously the Hungarian word for Hungarian is Magyar, which derives from the Magyar tribe, who are the people who come in off of Central Asia into the Carpathian Basin. And I was like, so why do we call them Hungarian? It's because we get it from, like, a different Turkic tribe who called them the Ungarn in early medieval period. So that's just a fun fact. But yeah, I mean, Hungary, the thing that's interesting about them is they're pretty normal. They did have a weird script. Have you seen this? The original Hungarian alphabet.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I thought you meant, like, movie script.
No.
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
Because, like, Hungarian, it is funny because Hungarian is a language that is so obviously not suited to Latin script.
Yeah.
It looks really weird.
Well
it looks really weird to non-Hungarian. It is biased, but it's like Welsh, you know, where the phonetics are very different from, like, most kind of Germanic or Romance-derived languages.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely.
But they do pop... They mostly just sort of pop up in wider plot lines, Hungarians.
We love them for that. Paonia says, free space for Olivia to be a textile nerd. Current projects, favorite fiber fests, and yarn shops, any techniques you want to try... I think recently I've been more into the natural dyeing aspect of it because I don't like to buy stuff. I just, like, it feels with, like, spinning and fiber arts, it's like the whole point is it should be sort of sustainable and circular. So I have a couple sources where I get my fleeces from. I don't really buy that much apart from that. I try not to, actually, although, you know, you get a hankering for something specific occasionally. But yeah, I'm big into the natural dyeing. I really like getting out into nature, get some foraging done, get you some lichens, get you some mushrooms. There's a whole world of natural color out there. Weigh in on DPNs versus 9-inch circs versus magic loop. Not even a question. I'm sorry. DPNs are the oldest. They're the oldest. I mean, they're medieval. They've existed since the Middle Ages. Magic loop, fuck off. Circs...
Olivia, what does any of this mean?
They're just different types of knitting needles, okay? Circular needles, absolutely not. Miss me with those, like, interchangeable sets. Like, just so... I don't know, just feels so consumeristic. They're so expensive. Again, like, I'm really just all for, like, simplicity. I think whatever is, like, the cheapest, easiest, and, like, is still effective is best. And I really don't like to buy things. So, yeah, I'm always gonna go for, like... the basic route, go down to the shops, get some wooden DPNs for like $3.99, bish, bash, bosh, you're good.
Bosh.
We have a question for Joe Mason. Mm. What do you think the Roman dodecahedra were for? Now, in case you don't know what the Roman dodecahedra are, they're basically metal dodecahedra that were made by Romans, but Whoa. We don't know why.
They have little bubbles on them.
They're little bubbles, and they have holes, and there have been lots of suggestions for what they were used for, and none of them are convincing. I've read every theory. I don't like any of them.
I have a theory. I think they were doohickeys.
Yeah, I...
They were just decorative.
No, I think, if anything, they were, like, knickknacks.
Yeah.
Or tchotchkes.
Yeah, fair enough.
Or maybe
yeah.
thingamabobs.
Yes, thingamabob is, I think, probably the right word.
Yeah.
I think they were probably just, like, a fad. Like, here's a thing to have in your house.
Yeah. I did. I read something about how, like, they were related to, like, the divine geometry of, like, the sexagesimal system, and that, like, they've also found icosahedrons, which are, like, 20-sided solids, and there was a whole classical philosophy of, like, the symbolism of different solids, and different solids, like, representing different, like, elements. I don't remember all of it, but I think that's the one that makes the most sense to me, because, like, 12 is probably the most, like, sacred number intrinsically. What does Joe Mason have to say about this?
When I asked him this, he just sent me a gif of a man's face melting off.
Nice one. Classic Joe. Lentil asks, if all of the medieval kings of Britain were in a battle royale situation, who do you think would win?
I'm gonna change the question slightly. I'm gonna restrict, because I think this might be we could be here forever. I'm gonna suggest that we stick to the ones from the Norman Conquest series, because otherwise I think my brain's gonna melt.
Yeah. In that case, I'm saying Knut. Knut was the one who came into, like, a basically foreign country and established himself as the top dog. So I think he would be able to probably get, I think, Ethelred, Edward.
Oh, they're gone instantly.
So I'm saying he would be able to get them on his side. They would be like, sure, Knut, we'll do what you say.
Oh, right.
You know, I think he was, like, he probably had a lot of clout. I think he was probably quite a charismatic guy.
I think Knut is a really good answer. I think William the Conqueror... He initially scans as, like, a guy who would do well in that situation. He would just start freaking out. I think yeah. He does not have the mentality for it. He's not resilient enough. Other people who I think could have a solid go of it, I think Malcolm Canmore would be a decent shot.
Yeah.
Just like a kind of guy who kind of keeps his head for most of the story.
Yeah.
But is a good fighter. And then if we're gonna... Harald Hardrada.
Yeah.
He would just be, like, doing derring do.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
He would be, like, swashbuckling on the side of a castle.
Yeah, I don't know if he counts as a medieval king of Britain, but in my heart he does, yeah.
He had the most rightful claim.
Yeah, you know
what? It definitely
what?
Wasn't a fraudulent thing that Magnus made up.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And then if we're... Quick engagement, if we're not gonna talk about just the Norman Conquest series, Alfred the Great, definitely not.
No.
He was a little dork.
I mean, Longshanks, maybe.
Longshanks, I mean, honestly.
I think he's a good tip.
I would accept Robert Bruce or Edward Longshanks.
Yeah.
They would be really good answers.
Yeah, make them kiss.
Wait. Oh, actually, you know, Owain Glyndŵr.
Yeah, actually,
he's
yeah,
a guerrilla fighter.
That's the canonical answer.
Owain Glyndŵr, he's a strong leader. He's a guerrilla fighter. He's a, you know, a statesman.
Yeah,
I think it might be Owain Glyndŵr.
He's the best all-rounder, for sure.
Yeah.
But I mean,
Robert Bruce is a solid answer.
Because
he has a lot of the same strengths of Owain Glyndŵr, but Owain Glyndŵr is just more of a kind of hard-bitten just guy who's happy to live on a hill.
I think it comes down to a three-way between Owain Glyndŵr...
Now you're just reading your fan fiction.
Yeah. Longshanks and Robert the Bruce. I think probably they team up on Longshanks just because they hate him.
Yeah.
And then I think in hand-to-hand combat, Robert the Bruce probably does something slightly, like, inopportune. He probably, like, I don't know, trips, or he, like, just
yeah.
gets, I don't know, he gets really angry. Maybe he's making, like, a dramatic speech. And I think, like, he gives Owain Glyndŵr, like, an opportunity, an opening.
And then anybody else? I mean, part of me wants to be like, oh, what about the Black Prince? But A, the Black Prince was never king.
Yeah.
And also, he's a bit too much of a show pony.
And I've heard people say, oh, Richard the Lionheart. No, absolutely not.
Interesting.
No, he's getting his skull kicked in. I'm sorry.
Okay, so we're set. We got two brackets.
Yeah.
Or we got two divisions.
I would really like to see a bracket of this, actually, yeah.
Oh, man. Somebody make that on the Discord, please.
Yeah. Hazel Riss says, my question, favorite proto-Protestantism movement that got stamped out too soon?
You go first, because I think you and I have very different, like, ways of determining favorite.
I mean, I've always been a Lollards head. I think they're cool.
Explain the Lollards.
I don't know, I think a solid all-rounder, like, very egalitarian, everything you want out of a proto-Protestant movement, just the cast-iron skillet of proto-Protestant movements, if you ask me. Just,
yeah.
Like, you know, no icons, no britches for the churches, like, you can't really go wrong there.
No britches for us churches.
No Jesus for Mises, like, yeah.
Yeah. I am 50-50. I think on the one hand, it's the Hussites, and then it's, on the other hand, it's Savonarola in Florence, for very different reasons. Hussites are very, like, classic proto-Protestant in that they kind of do have all the classic Martin Luther stuff, plus the, like, we're bohemians, we want our own church.
Yeah.
But those fucking wagons, man. I love their wagons.
Oh, yeah.
So for those who don't know, the Hussites were able to kind of fend off the predations of Catholic Europe by their innovative use of battle wagons, which are just like, they use them as like...
I've been described as having a battle wagon.
All right, calm down. People are getting too excited.
Yeah.
But like... There, you could use them to sort of assemble, like, fortifications on the battlefield, which is an insane innovation. And then I love Savonarola because he's such a theatrical lunatic. There's a real strain of, like, Rolla Khomeini in Savonarola, I think. And I also just like the phrase bonfire of the vanities is great. There's a reason why that stuck around. Like, but Savonarola is also interesting because he's so much more radical in some ways than, like, what will come after him.
Yeah.
And that is kind of what leads him to flame out.
Nice.
Literally, of course, because of the whole hot coals thing.
Oh, yeah.
Look it up.
Leah says, you need to do episode about gays in medieval times for Pride Month.
The vibe would not be the vibe that you're hoping for, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the history of homosexuality in the Middle Ages is sparse and, you know, fraught with violence and unhappy endings. Unfortunately, like, there isn't... I don't know if I could find, like, a single story in the Middle Ages that I would feel really confident about, like, promoting as a good example of, like, as something uplifting or interesting or in the spirit of Pride Month. And I know that there are probably things that people write in where they will say there's, you know, this person or this person. But I think when you consider, like, the scarcity of sources and how these things are just so reliably mischaracterized by contemporary sources, it's just, like, speaking as a queer person myself, I think, like, I'm really interested in narratives that involve, like, queering the Middle Ages and queer interpretations and reading of the Middle Ages. Obviously, there's quite a bit about Joan of Arc, although there's a lot more depth to the subject than that. And so I think I'm more interested in, and have been since I started Medieval, Weird Medieval Guys, how, like, queer people connect with the Middle Ages, not just as something where we can see ourselves literally reflected one-to-one in terms of identity, but as, like, a vessel or a medium for expressing sort of queer narratives and stories.
Yeah, I think it's a useful comparison point to come back to the thing we were saying earlier about the Jewish history episode, where the whole point of that episode is we didn't want to talk about pogroms and we didn't want to talk about oppression and expulsions because you know that. And what I worry about with a sort of queer history episode is that we would get stuck on either the talking about that and talking about prohibition exclusively, or we, which would be a, is not a, the tone for Pride Month. Yeah. You know, I don't think the state of the world makes me feel like we need more stories about queer people being, like, brutalized, to be honest.
Yeah.
But also, if we were, the alternatives to that is mostly that we do the sort of they were roommates thing. And we take people who clearly had very strong relationships with somebody else of the same sex, and we say, and they were dating, and they kissing. And that is also, I think, that's fine as a to say as a throwaway joke, but I think turn that into a sort of, like, robust narrative about, like, who those people were, I would feel really uncomfortable about that.
Yeah.
And what that and so what does that leave you with? It kind of leaves you, like, with things like the tradition of, like, you know, of the Islamic tradition that's inherited from the Greeks about, like, you know, same-sex relationships between sort of older men and young boys, which,
yep,
I don't love the sort of implications of being like, this is what being gay is about.
Yeah.
Like, that makes me very uncomfortable. Yeah. So I think that queering the Middle Ages is a really important thing. I think that, I think it's really interesting the way that people kind of latch on to a lot of characters from the Middle Ages. Okay, let's talk about Joan of Arc a little bit, because I think Joan of Arc is really, really, Joan of Arc is fascinating because obviously she is a, from her own statements, which we have an unusual amount of, she's a deeply, like, Catholic woman, and she has, even for the standards of her time, kind of conservative ideas about women. Like, you can see this in the rare times when we have recorded interactions with her and other women who want to kind of do what she's doing. She has no time for it.
Yeah.
She thinks she can do it because she's Joan of Arc, not because she thinks that's the role that women should have. And obviously the whole, like, people reading into her dressing as a man and saying this is her being non-binary, or this is her being trans, or this is her being a lesbian, is, like, I think a real misreading of what she was doing. But also, what she was doing was incredibly transgressive, and she was crossing gender boundaries, not in a way that necessarily somebody, that a queer person might do now, but I can see people taking heart. I can totally understand people taking heart from that, and I think that's a really positive thing.
Yeah. And when we start our, you know, criticism, like, podcast, then we'll talk about that. But yeah, it's outside of our scope, I think, for now, unfortunately.
Now, that being said, if between now and Pride Month, I come across something that changes my feelings about this, I would love to do an episode about that. I think it'd be tremendous fun. But that would have to happen first.
Yeah.
My headspace, because there have been quite a few Pride Months that have happened since we started this podcast, and we conspicuously haven't done this.
And we're not trying to say that these stories that we're looking for did not happen, but no. they were probably not written down.
They wouldn't have been recorded, because that would have been a mad thing to do. It's like, you know, well, it's like, think about people who live now in countries where homosexuality is criminalized or is really dangerous because of state or non-state violence. You have to not write shit down, and you have to be very, very careful about how you do that. And I think that, you know, the history of queer people in the Middle Ages is probably a history of a lot of people doing things in secret, which does not help historians at all. Because we have to work with what's there.
RBKP says, what has been your favorite episode to record / research so far? I'm going to be really problematic and go all the way back to the start and say the vampire one.
That will always be
my favorite one that we did. We gave us gay Dracula. I got to say that medieval vampires were the same as people not wanting their kids to eat Halloween candy.
That had switchblades in it or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. It was a good time.
It was a good time. I think...
We got to talk about some real spooky stuff.
Yeah, it was...
It was a spooked up, great episode.
I mean, I think for me, my favorite one to record and research was probably the Vikings in the Arctic episode for two reasons. Number one... Because I really like kind of stories of cultural exchange. And I really like talking about non-European medieval history, despite what we were saying earlier. And the other reason is that we got to do it with Joe. And those recording sessions have such a different energy.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I feel like I categorically can't choose one with Joe because I still don't know... whether I was there. it all feels like a dream.
He sort of unlocks something in both of us.
Well, you're the one that called him the human gas leak. Yeah. I think it was Rui that called him, like, Bacchanalian. It's a bit of both.
But yeah, I feel like there's... Okay, so there's... I'm going to answer this seriously.
Inside of you are two wolves. One of them is Bacchus. One
is
in a house with a gas leak.
They're both Joe Mason. But yeah, hi Joe, you're listening to this, I know you are. I feel like there's kind of three categories of episodes that we've done. First of them is the Joe Mason episodes, which are such a different energy to record. And then they come out and they have a different energy as well. Because again, it's like a stepladder. It's like a staircase. We just keep competing for jokes. And then there are the sort of regular ones that are just like you and me talking about a topic. And those are the sort of the most laid back ones. And then there are the narrative ones are interesting because that is a completely different process.
Yeah.
From like conception to execution. And that's why we've only ever done three of them so far. Because, like, usual episode, here's the process. We will agree a topic, we will make a Google Doc, we will then go away and have entirely unrelated research streams come together, have a conversation, and make a structure for an episode, right? And that, whereas in the, and we just talk it out. However much we've researched, we talk it out. And with the narrative ones... You have to figure, not only do you have to research and everything, you have to figure out what the beats are. You have to, it's essentially, the way that I approach it is like, it's like we're writing a movie.
Yeah.
Because you have to figure out what the key scenes are, who your key characters are, you're going to follow. And that informs your structure. Like, for example, like the Joan of Arc episodes, I remember we did two things that I think were very like, meant to kind of steal from cinema, like cinema writing, which is number one, we revealed information generally as Joan learned it. And second of all, we had that fun, like dipping back and forth between the sort of the present day of the courtroom trial and then the sort of the lead up to that. And that was really fun. And that was like meant to be like a courtroom kind of procedural story. But like with the Hundred Years' War, not the Hundred Year, with the Norman Conquest series, I think I was struggling with the research, I think, initially, because I couldn't figure out who the kind of, like, I couldn't get the emotional thread. And that's, to tell a narrative story, you need that. And bizarrely, the character who kind of unlocked it all for me, and I think you feel a similar way about this, is Tostig.
Yeah, I mean,
because it's all on the surface.
I think we definitely take different approaches, yes. though. I mean, I'm not really a storyteller at all by nature. And I think when we go into these episodes, I honestly don't... I think I approach the episodes much more similarly than do you, the storytelling versus the more kind of analytical ones. Because I think even with a story, and maybe this comes from not being a historian, I think I'm always kind of like... I think I'm usually, you know, the one that's pushing back on, like, let's not editorialize too much. I don't want to, you know, extrapolate too much or project onto this too much, which, of course, you know, even with a history podcast is something that you can and should do to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Within reason.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think we transgress, you know, beyond the boundaries of that at all. But nevertheless, I think I'm usually the one that's like, you know, no, it's not a movie. It happened. So what happened? But actually, you know. But yeah, that's something that, you know, you also need to temper. But yeah, I think I'm always sort of thinking about, like, what are the ramifications? You know, how does this fit into, like, the broader thread of history? You know, the way I see it. And yeah. That obviously involves a lot of extrapolation, too.
Yeah. Which is also the actual what the value is. But I've always felt like to get to that point, you need something other than... And this is now getting into, like, I think a wider point about how we approach all of these things. I think one of the reasons why a lot of people kind of get turned off of history in high school and so on is that you just hear a bunch of names and dates... And you think that if you memorize the names and dates, you'll pass?
Yeah.
When in actual fact, what you need to understand is causality. That's what history is about, is it like understanding how, and being able to analyze causality and explain why you think that this caused this. And to do that, you need the two wolves inside of you of this is a narrative and... cold, hard kind of, like, analysis of, like, this is a real series of events.
Yeah, because any recollection, the boundary between history and fiction is much blurrier, of course, than most of us perceive. Mm-hmm. And the idea of objective truth is one that's only really going to get us so far in the end. I mean, I could write my autobiography and say, oh, I thought this person was always a really big bitch. And there would be no more truth
Who
in that.
Who could that be?
Objectively than if I said, oh, you know, Tostig Godwinson was a bitch. Like, both of them are coming from an extremely limited perspective. And so, yeah, it's just about acknowledging that as well, as much as it is trying to aspire or claim to show something that's objective and true.
Yeah. To bring this back to the question, I do want to address what my least favorite episodes to record were, which is my least favorite one we ever did was the second Christmas episode, when we recorded an entire other episode first. And then we got 40 minutes into the second one that we were recording, and then realized that we lost those 40 minutes, had to do it again.
Yep.
And that's why that episode has the most cracked energy of all time, is because I am straight up having a terrible time.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, like, we both were, and I remember, like, you saying, oh, well, we could just call it quits and go home and, you know, be us both being like, nope. What we're going to do is I'm going to go to the store. I'm going to buy another bottle of wine. It's 10:30 p.m. and we're just going to do it because to talk about the snowman miracle of Bruges or Brussels. I think it
Brussels.
Was Brussels.
It was Brussels.
1517 or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm glad we did, but it was not easy.
Physically, it was an exhausting experience.
Yep. And mentally, I would say as well. God.
It was. Don't ever do that.
Paleo Rob says, anti-pope drama. Who were they? Where did they come from? Just seems so interesting and different from how religious groups treat theological differences today, where they just start a new thing instead of claiming to be the actual thing.
So anti-popes are so interesting because the name is kind of misleading. And I think that also the problem with anti-pope as a category is that it's accepting a narrative about who the legitimate popes are that is kind of backwards projected from the guys who got to write the history.
I mean, it's a great name, like the Waluigi Pope. You know, yeah. It really does make you just think of an evil pope.
It's like upside down. It's like it's you think of it as like an upside down pope. You yeah. know? But like, I think the thing about anti-popes is they're usually with the asterisk of like the very early Christian period where all this shit is still being figured out. Like anti-popes tend not to be caused by religious schisms per se. It's more that, especially in the early sort of medieval period, there's not a formalized process for picking a pope. It's all a bit vague, right? It's not Conclave brackets 2024 starring Ralph Fiennes. It's like, it's all much, much messier. And that means that there's a lot more contested kind of, contested selections. And of course, the quote unquote secular powers of Europe are going to get involved in that and back various claimants. And so if you look at a list of anti-popes on Wikipedia, you will see that the numbers, they bulge at various points, but like the frequency of anti-popes starts declining pretty much from the 6th century to the 14th. And the point about religious differences is, I think, quite important, because I think it does speak to a fundamental thing that the Protestant Reformation kind of creates in a way, which is the idea that you can kind of have you can pick your religion. That, like, because obviously every religion thinks it's the one true religion, right? Obviously.
Yeah.
But I think that a medieval person would kind of struggle with the idea that there are, like, all these different sects that just kind of coexist. I think that they would struggle to understand how could that possibly be sustainable? Because, like, you do have schisms, and obviously you have the conflict between the kind of, like, the Eastern Church centered in Constantinople and the Western Church centered in Rome. And then, of course, in Asia, they're doing something completely different as well. But that distinction itself, the sort of the breaking off of the Greek Orthodox world from the Catholic world, is a very gradual process. It's not linear. And it is, remember, initiated by geopolitics. The fundamental reason why the Pope in Rome picks Charlemagne to be the Holy Roman Emperor is because the Byzantine Emperor cannot protect him.
Yes, exactly. And it's, again, geopolitical and geographical. And mm-hmm. The church system, you know, the Catholic Church in medieval Western Europe was not able to sustain geographical overlap really with other Christian sects.
Mm-hmm.
And it was empowered to basically stomp out those sects with complete, you know, an utter authority. And so, you know, I think it's also, there's a continuity between the Catholic Church of then and the Catholic Church of now in that both churches see themselves as the one true church and see other churches and other sects of Christianity as heresy or whatever. I don't know. What's the difference? Heresy, fucking apostasy.
Apostasy. We can't get into that.
I don't even know. They think the other churches are bad.
Well, they have to, but I think that there is a fundamental difference from now, which is that now what Protestantism introduces is the idea that religion is a personal choice.
Yes. No, exactly. And so that's, you know, that is that what we've gotten in addition to. But I think, like, the ideological underpinnings of what made, you know, these situations like multiple competing popes happen, like, those are still there in the Catholic Church. Yeah. You just have more options.
Yeah.
But, like, the Pope would probably still, you know, the Pope still has the same feelings about that, basically.
Yeah.
He just can't do as much about it because it's not legal anymore.
I think one of the reasons why there aren't anti-popes in the modern world is that basically there is a sort of venting shaft for religious schisms, which is just you get to most, the vast majority of societies now are at least secular enough that you could go off and start your own thing. Whereas you don't have, in a world where there is just the church and you have your local version of that, it's not a, it isn't really, if there is an ideological difference, it has to be resolved within the frameworks that they have.
And again, like, I don't think the ideological framework has changed that much.
No,
like,
no.
You can say that, like, the king is the anti-pope of the current pope. The king of England is the anti-pope of the pope, and that both of them purport themselves to be the head of the one true religion. Again, what has been taken out of the equation is the ability to enforce that with violence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because God knows they tried during the Reformation, and it didn't work.
They tried for a lot, yeah.
They cook. This is where we get the phrase "your goose is cooked," because the Hus means Jan Hus. His name means goose, and they fucking cooked him.
I don't believe that.
I do.
I'm sorry. That smacks of falsehood. Next, you're gonna tell me OK was invented in Boston. Cranog asks, how's Deborah Goodwitch doing? I hope she has a fantastic New England autumn without any shit pranksters messing up her herb garden over Halloween.
So she's been going to a lot of protests recently. You can infer about what. Other than that, she's fine.
Lentil asks, how on earth did people in the Middle Ages communicate when they traveled abroad? Like, say someone goes off from England to Morocco, do they just walk around and hope to find someone who speaks English to hire as a translator? Especially when you hear about when people went to China, that must have been even harder to find someone who can speak French or English.
Yeah, so one of the things that is important to note about travel in the Middle Ages, and we will do an episode about, like, travel as a general kind of concept eventually, but, like, travel, the people's travel in the Middle Ages tended to be along kind of very well-established routes. Because it's like, well, we got to get this, you know, we got to get this spices from Alexandria to Venice. Where are you going to go? You're probably going to go the same way that everybody else does. And that means that a lot of the major kind of destination cities had pre-existing communities of expats who you would sort of slot alongside to. And you, I mean, there's loads of stories about how unbearable the Flemish are in London, for example. And it's like, well, if you're a Flemish person who needs to go to London, you'll, you know, go and find the Flemish people in London.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you what's up. The more kind of, the one that we know less about and the more interesting one is the, like, genuine explorers. I mean, obviously, huge health warning that, like, every single medieval travel log up to and including the sort of the life and times of Marco Polo, and especially Marco Polo,
yep,
you should treat with, you know, with enormous suspicion. But I think it's very interesting that Marco Polo, who is one of the rare cases of, like, a Christian European going to somewhere very dramatically different where there are basically no other Europeans, they completely obfuscate the language point. It does not come up, which is fascinating. Like, there's only one point, I think I read a bit of the Adventures of Marco Polo, and there's one bit where he's like, of course, Marco Polo and his companions were already fluent in the tongue of the Tatars, which by which they mean the Mongolians. And I was just like, how? Have they met a Mongol guy? But, like...
Yeah.
And sidebar, but there's a brilliant... There's a whole... Marco Polo doesn't get into this, but a book that we both love, Invisible Cities, which, yeah, features a dialogue between Marco Polo and Kublai Khan, has a fantastic section where Marco Polo is kind of breaking down the language barrier by communicating through, like, abstract symbols. And it's... Calvino's a good writer, what can I say?
Oh, yeah, yeah, we love Calvino.
We love Calvino, we love Invisible Cities.
And I think it's, you know, worth pointing out that you have the traders who have their sort of well-established networks. Yes. You have the explorers who are definitely having a really difficult time communicating and probably having to adapt quite quickly. The other mobile groups of people in the Middle Ages mostly are the church.
The pilgrims.
And associated people and the the pilgrims and the aristocracy, arguably, maybe to a lesser extent. But these are people for whom you have, like, sort of linguas franca, pardon the euphemism, you know. This is why, like, Latin is so prevalent, why it's necessary for the church and therefore for the education systems, the universities, to have one language that everyone speaks, because then you can go anywhere and talk to any of your peers. And that's why Paris has a Latin quarter, because people from all over the place would just come around and talk Latin to each other.
And why the exact same thing happens in Islam and Judaism with Arabic and Hebrew.
Exactly. And the nobles, you know, have French. French is very widely spoken in Western Europe. Pilgrims, I think, you know, you're much more likely to be in, you know, you're in a big group of people. International pilgrimages, I think, are also just much, much less common.
But yeah.
Yeah.
You're probably going to the, at most, most pilgrims are going to, like, the cathedral three counties away, at most.
Jay asks, medieval aesthetics have made their way back into mainstream / high fashion / pop culture. Any highlights for y'all?
Well, it's a terrible representation of Joan of Arc, but I really liked Chapel Roan's Joan of Arc kind of costume in the, I think it was the VMAs, like last year. That was fantastic. I think I'm fine, like, that has all the cardinal sins of, like, bad Joan of Arc representation, because it has the boob armor.
But it's camp, you know, it's fun.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is it's meant to be an abstraction of medieval aesthetics. And then obviously there's, like, there's a strain of it that it sort of does make me deeply uncomfortable, which is the sort of, like, the way that kind of, via the games like Crusader Kings, like phrases like Deus Vult and just the general kind of Crusader aesthetic has re-entered political, like, discourse. I mean, the U.S. Defense Secretary has a Deus Vult tattoo, which 20 years ago, can you even imagine?
Yeah.
But then I have another, like, absolutely crank theory, which is that I think a lot of sort of medievalist aesthetics that are kind of more diffuse are not actually kind of, and this is especially the case for, like, Catholic aestheticism. I think a lot of the, like, Catholic, like, ultra-Catholic kind of, especially, like, very Orthodox tradition, quote-unquote trad cath aesthetics, are not actually borrowing from Catholicism, I think.
Yeah.
They're borrowing from Warhammer 40,000. Which is, in and of it, like, that's a big claim to make, because obviously the kind of the gothic aesthetic of the, Olivia can just check out for the next 5 minutes. The gothic,
sorry, I'm looking for a specific photo shoot that I saw.
The gothic aesthetic of the Imperium in 40K is very obviously pulled from sort of medieval Catholicism, but I think that the version of that aesthetic that people are borrowing from, which is the sort of incredibly heightened over the top. Olivia's just shown me a Wikipedia page saying history of cleavage.
Wow.
So I'm very excited to find out where this is going. I'm going to keep talking about Warhammer instead of thinking about cleavage.
You're not
going to
believe it, but they had the smile of the bust line.
Oh, you're going to talk about
the
peasant,
the
peasant dress.
No.
Oh.
That's what they actually called it in the Middle Ages.
But yeah, I think please keep looking at boobs while I'm talking about Warhammer. I think that, like, that there are kind of, and I think we've talked about this before, but, like, there are kind of various different representations of, trends within the representation of the Middle Ages. I think one of them is this kind of, this, like, trad cath gothic aesthetic, which is, I'm sorry, just is, like, it is Warhammer. You're engaging with Warhammer, you're not engaging with the Middle Ages. And then there is the sort of the Chapel Roan in the suit of armor, like, you know, queering the Middle Ages, which I think is really, I find it a more kind of honest engagement with the Middle Ages, because it's an engagement with the fact that the Middle Ages is a strange and alien kind of culture. And I think that's what draws what a lot of people are drawn to, is the kind of fundamental strangeness of it. And I think that people like Olivia have been very important. You have been important in sort of helping to popularize the strangeness of marginalia.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. I like to think so.
Now tell me about boobs.
No, it's...
No, you started, so you'll finish.
No, I'll do whatever I want. Right, yeah, it was Sylvester Mako. Was he the guy that shot Rama Duwaji? He might have been. Yes, he was. So, if you liked the Zoran wife photo shoot, as I hope you did, because it was good taste and very well done, then you should look into the photographer Sylvester Mako. He's a Hungarian photographer. I think the mention of high fashion is particularly something I wanted to touch on, because you do see it, like, I think you're probably less tapped into this than I am, but you do see it, like, on the runway and in the sort of editorial fashion world, the world of fashion editorials.
What makes you think I'm not tapped into the editorial fashion world? What can possibly give you that impression?
You do see, like, and I think that's also what is particularly, like, noteworthy, is the fact that it has not only become, you know, part of pop culture, but it has medieval-inspired designs and fashions and, you know, aesthetics have also definitely established themselves at this point as sort of a current thing in the high fashion and the couture world. And that's quite cool to see, because I think even like 5 years ago, it would have come across as, like, I think quite corny, and it would have been sort of scoffed at. Whereas I think, like, in the fashion world of probably like my teenagerhood, where it was kind of, you know, it was like a bit of a thing to be like, oh, like, want a woman with in armor with a sword. And it was like sort of based on this almost like fantasy inspired aesthetic. I think, like, right now, because it's in this, like, high fashion state, you see medieval things being portrayed through this lens of, like, being sort of more raw and almost, like, playing into medieval beauty standards themselves of, like, you have these, like, models and these outfits that are, like, very stark and have this, like, very strong contrast.
Well, who's the hottest young actor at the moment? Timothy Chalamet. He would have done very well. Middle Ages.
He was in the medieval movie, so.
He was in the medieval movie, that's true, and he looked good.
The medieval movie. So, yeah. I think definitely, like, looking at the high fashion stuff, very, very much enjoying that. I'm not a gamer, so I've not played Pentiment, despite the fact that people have mentioned it to me.
Constantly for the last 3 years.
Yeah, sorry, no, I don't think it's gonna happen. I don't play video games. But... yeah, I mean, shout out my least favorite medieval-inspired thing, which is, like, bardcore. Like, if I have to hear the, like, Chapel Roan Pink Pony Club hurdy-gurdy, probably AI-generated cover, absolutely not. Literally would rather choke on a hurdy-gurdy. I don't really enjoy that stuff. It just feels so reductive and really boring. It's like, oh, a take thing, but make it medieval.
But so, what if you did?
Then I would be very bored with the results and not impressed, is the answer.
You can kiss 100 bolt lads in taverns.
Yeah.
You can kiss 100 squires in stalls.
Yeah.
Because it's a horse.
Yeah. St. Matthias said, what do you think about the repeated metamorphoses of the Weird Medieval Guys brand from a Twitter account to a book to a podcast to a surprisingly self-sustaining Discord community? And where will it head next?
Space.
A product launch? Weird Medieval Ties? Weird Medieval Rice? space is good, yeah.
I mean, it is... How do you feel about this? Because you started this whole thing. This is your baby.
Yeah, it is. It is my baby. When I started, you know, I was definitely slightly sort of embarrassed by it, because I just, it should need no explaining why, like, you know, a 22-year-old girl would be embarrassed about, like, telling people that she has a viral Twitter account, much less after, like, I quit my job and it being a viral Twitter account became, like, my full-time job in a sense, among other things.
It's like writing a book was sort of more salient.
Based on a viral Twitter account, yeah. But that's the beauty of Weird Medieval Guys, is it can be anything. Weird Medieval Guys is not even an idea. It's a community. It's a group of people. And as long as there's people interested in both the guys I have to offer and the Weird Medieval Guys that are Aaron and I think we'll keep doing this to our heart's content.
Well, this has always been the sort of the great ambiguity at the heart of this podcast. Who are the Weird Medieval Guys being described? Is it the subject of the podcast or is it the host?
It's the subject.
Or is it the people who listen?
I always assumed it was the subject. Sorry, that's not what I'm supposed to say. Exactly. It's anyone's guess. Maybe it's all three. Maybe the podcast is the link.
If there's one thing that is more embarrassing than having a viral Twitter account, it is, as a heterosexual man in your 20s, having to say to people that you have a podcast.
But when people ask you what you do for work, you don't have to say, I have a podcast.
No, but that's why I don't tell people about this. Well, yeah. Because I don't have to.
But then, you know, it's interesting because, on the other hand, I see it as, like, a success story of what people, you know, in a like, completely organic community can create on the internet. I really see it as, like, one of the positive internet success stories of my life.
Mm.
That it's just, like, it's such a positive group of people. It's been such a positive experience. I don't really take that for granted, you know. I'm grateful for everyone that engages and is interested. And I think right now I'm not taking an expansionist sort of point of view or approach to it. I think even as I came to terms with, like, being the Weird Medieval Guys girl, now I embrace it. Now I'm all about it. That kind of coincided with, you know, me planning some other projects in my life and different directions that are very much fueled by and taking, you know, cues from Weird Medieval Guys, but do not center Weird Medieval Guys explicitly. But I think the podcast for me right now is, like, where it's at. So if you're listening to this, you're listening to the beating heart of the guys. And I think I'm quite interested in maybe doing a live event this year, I think would be,
ooh,
it's something we've talked about for ages.
We've talked about it for literally 2 years.
It would just be a colossal amount of work to do, yeah. But I think, you know, it's a gamble, but it could pay off. And
it would be really fun. I'd love to do it.
And I really want to have a Halloween party in London.
That feels very achievable.
I think that would be super achievable. But if you're located in or willing to travel to London, like, drop a comment.
Yes.
This is our first feeler.
Yeah. And I think for me, there was when the podcast started, there was a deep sort of sense of cringe, not at the podcast itself, but at the sort of, like, feeling that I had, that I was sort of like, this was not fully my thing. Like, this was, I was here on sufferance, and that was sort of, that was very weird. I don't feel like that anymore. I could tell you what to do.
Yeah, definitely. You say jump, I say
no.
Sure.
But you say, no, I'm cozy.
Yeah, well, I am.
Yeah. And I think that I also feel, though, the sense that, like, that I don't take for granted the fact that Weird Medieval Guys has become what it has, because I think that it is in many ways both the podcast and the Discord community, everything that's come out of it. Like, it feels to me what the internet was kind of supposed to be.
Yeah.
And in a weird, I think we both try and bring a bit of old internet energy to the whole thing, which is why it's so low yeah, budget.
Exactly.
we are leaving money on the table just to make this podcast worse. No, but, like, and the fact that it has attracted people who are capable of being fucking normal is so nice to me.
All of you are so nice and normal, and we talk about it, like, not infrequently. Like, isn't it amazing that everyone who listens to the podcast is, like, really nice and really normal?
Yeah.
I mean, that we've gotten, like, two or three sort of, like, personal attacks over the course of making this. None of them were even that scathing, you know? No. I mean, if people...
One of them was pretty scathing.
Well, anyways. So, yeah, you know, this season, Weird Medieval Guys, the focus is on gratitude. It's about eating soup. It's about having beers with Aaron and recording the podcast we love.
Yes.
It's about going to see Joe Mason in Norwich. That's it.
And Joe Mason coming to us sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's just about going to do us for another episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. We will be back next week for a very special episode to celebrate the end of Dry January, which we've also not been observing, which is all going to be about booze in the Middle Ages. How did you make it? What was the cultural kind of what were the cultural connotations of different drinks?
How much did people raise on average for their Dry January marathon training fundraisers?
Fundraising for the local icons.
Yeah, exactly.
We got to replace these clapped icons.
When
with something
did ye
new.
Oldie Movember overtake ye oldie Dry January?
And if you enjoyed this episode and you enjoyed the show, you should leave us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. And you can also leave us a comment on Spotify. And if you do, Olivia might read one or two of them out.
So thanks to all of the kind comments and feedback we got on our Norman Conquest series, which we wrapped up. It was also our 50th episode was the last one we released. You're listening to our 51st, so thank you guys all so much.
It only took 2.5 years to do something that most podcasts do in like a week.
Yep. Thanks to Clem, who said, "There's no way that Harold Godwinson and William the Conqueror didn't explore each other's bodies in Flanders."
I be saying this.
Yeah. Oh, I've been saying this.
Everyone needs to get to work on writing more fanfiction.
I literally tweeted about this, so it had better happen.
Nice.
And thanks to Laura, who said, "Happy to report there are now 5 works on AO3.
Woo!
Presumably under the Harold Godwinson ex William the Conqueror tag. And I truly hope for more." We do too, Laura.
Yeah.
Again, please, guys, fight the good fight. I mean, these are important issues that society faces, so.
We need you to be our scribes.
Yeah. And, beyond that, thank you guys all so much for listening. Thanks for your thoughtful questions. Again, join the Discord. You can send us questions for the next one of these, and it would just be nice to have you there. So please hop on in, link in the description, and apart from that, we'll see you very, very soon.
Until next time.
Abash.
Take it easy.